House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, 2009. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 570.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 570 comes to you from a whole series of legislators. requires scrap metal business to create and maintain certain records pertaining to the purchase and transfer of metal property. Requires payment for all metal property in the form of a check mailed to the seller's home address. Creates a process for scrap metal business to retain metal property suspect to be lost or stolen. Provides that a scrap metal business must wait 3 business days before mailing payment for scrap metal purchase and other restrictions and prohibitions relating to scrap metal.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Stone.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind.
Oh, please.
Go up first.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brent Barton. I represent House District 51 in East Clackamas County. I will be very brief in my remarks. I'd like to talk about the procedure by which we came to this bill, and allow my colleague, Representative Olson, to give you a very brief 30,000-foot overview of some of the nuts and bolts of this bill. But as I believe everyone in this committee knows, Chair Barker appointed a work group with two of our colleagues in the Senate. I can tell you that, I suppose, speaking as just a freshman representative, this was it was really an extraordinary work group, and I think all of us came to the table truly with good faith, with open minds, and in the spirit of cooperation and bipartisanship, trying to be true problem solvers. It was truly a privilege to be a part of. This bill represents an extraordinary compromise on a lot of different points and a fairly complex problem. I think all of us involved in that process would recognize that it contains many imperfections, that further work in this issue will be necessary, that in a perfect world, particularly in a better revenue picture, this bill could be improved. But we truly have done the best we can with the given information we have. It's really been the product of a lot of different parties, and I appreciate my colleague to my right here very much, and it's been a positive experience for me, and hopefully ultimately will be for the people of Oregon as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area, and Mr. Chair, appreciate you assigning Representative Barton and myself to represent the House side regarding the work group on Senate Bill 570, along with Senators Brian Boquist and Floyd Brzezinski. You're aware that this bill passed unanimous over on the Senate side already. There has, and as Representative Barton has said, there's been a lot of work involved in this. There's been a number of bills that came forward, and we took a look at everything, pretty much similar to what Representative Krieger did years ago with the meth package omnibus bill. But you have written testimony for me, and I'm just going to walk through that a little bit. But Senate Bill 570 is a fairly comprehensive bill. It does a number of things, but it creates increased sanctions to offenders. It gives additional tools to law enforcement to combat metal theft. It protects agriculture, construction, transportation, and utilities. And it adds more accountability to the industry while taking into consideration they are a business and we need to protect our business here in the state. Here are some things that 570 does. Section 1, sub 2, describes what metal applies to this bill. And you can see that the four main venues, agriculture, construction, transportation, and utilities, are covered fairly well through this section. But the entire Section 1 is pretty much definition and description. Section 2 creates 3 new crimes that are Class A misdemeanors. And it's unlawful altering metal property with the intent to deceive, making a false statement on the metal property record, and unlawfully purchasing or receiving metal property. And it fails, failure to report to law enforcement within 24 hours is part of that third crime, and it involves whether the recycler had knowledge or believed that there was possible theft involved of the property that they were receiving, that the property they received had been altered somehow. And then also the big issue that we had noticed over the last year and a half, 2 years for research on this, was the insulated wire being burnt off, melted off, and then that copper being delivered. So those are the key picture of what Section 2 is all about. This bill takes the concept of the transportation certificate. As you recall, back in your old days, both you and Representative Krieger, with transportation certificates of hay, timber, and livestock, and applies it toward the metal as well for transporting across the highways of the state. The state police are charged with the design of some type of a certificate then that would apply and work well, and that makes that a Class C misdemeanor should you fail to have a transportation certificate for metal. This bill does add vehicle dealers, dismantlers, and towing businesses should they step into the business similar to metal recyclers. So if all of a sudden they begin to start collecting and receiving that, they then too have to fall in within the guidelines of what this bill was designed for. This adds also a kind of a unique step toward a sanction with aggravated factors involving the top four venues, again, agriculture, transportation, construction, and utility, for a disproportionate impact, and applies to theft of first degree or aggravated theft. The offender caused damage to the property during the commission of the cost or during the commission of the crime, and the cost of restoring the damaged property would be three times the value of the property that was taken, or the property taken creates a hazard to public health or safety or the environment. This is, and I think that was, you know, taking in consideration of what we were dealing with this session right now for the economy and everything, good fix toward wanting to really go after, you know, the perpetrator. Additionally, Senate Bill 570 recriminalizes failure to maintain records to a Class C misdemeanor. If you recall, last session we decriminalized it and made it a violation. This, and I greatly appreciate the industry because they felt that this should have been even stronger than a Class C misdemeanor. They felt that it should have probably been up in the neighborhood of an A misdemeanor rather than a C. But they most definitely wanted it to be recriminalized. So that was, you know, I appreciate that. Another piece that we've done here is we have a 3-business-day delayed check payment as well as no cash payment for the industry as well. This bill moves towards the communication between law enforcement and the industry. This is vital because what I've noticed over the last couple of years, especially with this coalition that has been kind of spearheaded by Jeff Stone up in Wilsonville, where we had a group from all different perspectives come to the table and share what their concerns were and how we could combat metal theft. A lot of what you're seeing here is from their input, and I was involved with that group a number of occasions. But one of the things that we've done that we've learned big time through this, Mr. Chair and committee members, is communication was huge. And I know Representative Barton and I, we had lots of talk about this during our work group, to the point where why not extend that where the DA, too, is involved with each county to create that communication base between the industry as well as law enforcement to open up the doors on the inspection issue, the communication back and forth for while if things that are suspected of theft be reported. That's where we're wanting to go with this, and what it does is it directs the DA of each county to have to come up with a plan and then report that to your local public safety coordinating council. Also what it does is a nice piece to this is it adds, can't recall the ORS number right offhand, but it adds to the one portion for mobile tracking device should an officer be involved with the investigation of a theft issue. For example, a farm that's losing its sprinkler heads and not able to irrigate properly and then loses thousands of dollars in the process. law enforcement would pursue obtaining a search warrant or a court order from the court based on probable cause, as what the statute identifies, and then could move forward with using some type of a mobile tracking device just to secure the investigation and also to pursue the perpetrator. This bill moves towards, finally, I believe this is a great step toward gaining control of metal theft in our state. And as I've described before, there's been a lot of people that have been involved in this, and I greatly appreciate this. I do think that there's two small little areas right now that I've talked with Senator Brzezinski about and Representative Barton, and we do need to kind of have just a little bit more tweaking on the bill. But other than that, I'm feeling very, very comfortable with where we're at with this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I stop my remarks with two points that I forgot to make on the first one. And I suspect that Representative Olson will agree with me on 2 points. We, Representative Olson and I, had the privilege of representing House representatives in this work group. And we did just that. We represented you, our colleagues. By no means were we the only people in the House of Representatives working on this issue. In particular, I think Representatives Kotek, Nathanson, and Matthews, and there were others, I don't mean to, just by mentioning those three, exclude others, really contributed in a great deal. And the final bill, what we have in front of us, absolutely reflects it, uses their specific input, and that's very much appreciated. The second point is, it has been said recently in some media outlets and others that this bill, I want to make sure that that this bill is not interpreted as somehow an attack on the industry, the scrap metal industry. I think Representative Olson and I view industry as actually some of the most important partners in combating metal theft. And I want to recognize that. This bill should not be construed otherwise. It is, to the extent it appears as such, often that certain approaches we had to take were due to fiscal considerations as much as anything.
Hey, thank you for those remarks. And I know at one point I was the sergeant in charge of the metal theft people in the Portland Police Bureau, and they had nothing but high regard for, especially CalBag Metals in Portland, as being somebody who really worked well with them trying to combat crime, even when metal prices were much lower. I want to thank both of you for the hard work you've done, and especially Representative Olson, that you worked so hard over the interim. I know you were in contact with law enforcement in other states working on this before the session even began. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greer.
Thank you. This is good work when you get work groups. You know, I do a lot of work groups rather than legislative task force. You get a product, it goes up on the shelf, and that dies. But when you take a long-term special interest in it yourselves, I think that's great. One thing, Representative Olson, you made the remark to the chair and myself back in your days, and I wonder if you would tell me what that meant. I wrote it down. That's exactly what you said.
Okay, so fine. Thank you.
Get him off the hook. Go ahead.
I'll get you off the hook. I just have a question with respect to the Dash A5s. Who is bringing those forward, or how are the, or are you guys aware of those? We have some Dash A5s at our seat.
I don't have them with me, and I'm trying to remember. Thank you. This is from the Loggers Association.
Okay.
And
okay.
I appreciate that, Representative Stiegler. And I've already had conversation with the work group, and they were good to go with this.
Okay.
Where it's at. And there's still just one other area that.
Now, that was my second question, was does this encompass the further little tweaking that you referred to, or is that in addition to?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Stiegler, it doesn't. And there was an area that I have a little bit of concern on, and I have to follow up on. It deals with the issue of receiving kegs.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, going to the issue of kegs, Representative Olson, and you're talking about Section 5, page 5 of the bill, is except as provided in subsection 2 of the section 1 to 4 of this Act, 2009 Act, and ORS 165-107 do not apply, A, to a person engaged in recycling beverage containers as defined in 459A-700, right?
That's correct.
Chairman of the committee. Representative Olson, in your opinion, does a keg fit within that definition, or is that the intent?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Council, yeah, taking a look at that statute, just I'll read it to you here, and it is ORS 459A700 sub 2. It says beverage container means the individual separate sealed glass, metal, or plastic bottle, can, jar, or carton containing a beverage. And then if you refer back to the original section, section 1, it has some discussion in regards to printing and stamping items that the industry themselves would not receive. My personal opinion, I think that this applies toward that. But I just want to confirm that a little bit more with legislative counsel to make sure.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Smith?
Do we have a schedule when we're planning on working the bill?
We're not going to work it today.
Just sometime soon. Great, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Stone? Mike Dykesville and Rex Storm? We have kind of a long agenda today, so I appreciate if you could be brief. Try not to turn on the egg timer just yet. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. The product that you have before you today is part two of a three-year saga of trying to get a bunch of stakeholders together and talk about the impacts of metal theft. For the nursery and greenhouse industry, we are impacted significantly by this issue. Sprinkler heads, irrigation pipe, a variety of things can be stolen, and it also puts at risk plant material. And I had a grower from Fisher Farms out in Gaston talk about it's just a matter of time before plants could be destroyed by metal thieves, especially as it goes up to 90 degrees this weekend. They can't stand that type of heat for very long. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair, and say that I had the honor of being the chair of the work group over the past several years. The product before you, and I want to be fair to our metal recycling friends, that it did not have uniformity. The no cash payment issue is one that we could not reconcile as a work group, but it is the legislative prerogative of your body to make changes to the bill as you see fit. As it is, we have a lot more work to do, and I have extended testimony before you to talk about all the different elements, but our work is not over. And so I encourage you to pass this bill. The Oregon Association of Nurseries fully endorses this bill and thinks it is good public policy. It gets at a lot of issues that we could not tackle 2 years ago, and I think that we still have work to do. So I appreciate your consideration of the amendments. The OAN and the work group support that set of amendments for our forestry friends, and I'll be happy to answer any questions at the end of my time.
Good, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Dykesville, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'd just like to echo all the hard work that everybody's done. We were not part of the work group on the day-in, day-out nuts and bolts, and I appreciate the technical aspects that you guys brought to this, a lot of time and energy. We do appreciate the consideration of the A5 amendments to include forestry and logging. And Representative Olson said something that kind of, you know, kind of triggered something for me with the burning off of the insulation. I go around to all 12 of the Forest Protective Associations around the state, and this last fall there was a story of a fire that took place down in the Coos Forest Protective Association where someone stole a very large quantity of insulated wire and was trying to be helpful and not start a forest fire, so he decided to crawl into a large culvert and go ahead and put all the material in there and then douse it with gasoline. And it blew out both sides of the culvert with the flame, and in a result of a fairly good-sized fire at a cost of about $130,000. So there are some, you know, additional ramifications. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Rex Storm. I'm a forest policy manager for Associated Oregon Loggers, which is a statewide trade group representing forestry and logging contractors in Oregon. We'd also like to thank the committee and work groups for their good work, and we encourage the committee to add the A5 amendments and to adopt those amendments. The original version of the Senate bill does not include forestry operations, which continue to be subject to theft and vandalism, in particular metal theft, due to the isolated nature of the forestry operations and where we work and do business. So thank you for your efforts. We support the bill.
Any questions this panel?
No.
Thank you, panel, very much. Chuck Bennett, Jason, and Kevin Campbell. Jason.
Great. Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I also have the privilege of representing the Associated Oregon Loggers. You've already heard about the A5 amendment, so I won't go into any greater detail on that. But I do want to mention that from the law enforcement perspective, we were involved, both the chiefs and the sheriffs, along with a number of other law enforcement representatives in the work group that Jeff Stone led. And then I also serve on the meth task force, which also forwarded a bill to the legislature dealing with metal theft. And it's in that regard that I'm particularly appreciative, as Representative Krieger mentioned, for the leadership that the legislature showed in bringing together what has been a number of different perspectives on how to solve this, brought it into a bill that I feel like is a very good product. And so from both of those organizations and from the chiefs and the sheriffs, I just want to echo and add my support to Senate Bill 570, and I appreciate all the good work on that. Law enforcement was participants all along the way. But this is a good product. I won't go into detail because you've heard all about the bill, but I want to add our support for the measure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm representing the City of Salem. I'm a member of the Salem City Council, and just wanted to also join in supporting this bill. I've given you written testimony. I can run through, if you wanted, a catalog of thefts that have occurred in the City of Salem affecting cultural objects, both private and public infrastructure, a whole variety of losses that have been compiled by our police department. But suffice it to say, it's substantial, it's valuable. Our police department's very concerned and asked me to be here today to express their strong support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Huser, legislative liaison for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. You have a copy of my testimony. I'm not going to read it. I'll try to just hit a few points. Also, in addition to my testimony, there's a second letter from all of Oregon's investor-owned utilities, consumer-owned utilities, their state associations, and some of the major telecom providers, all of whom support Senate Bill 570. I think the big attraction for utilities in this bill, we see a very strong deterrent factor, not only catching metal thieves after they've committed crime, but stopping some of these crimes from happening in the first place. Obviously, for electric utilities, when you think of electric substations being hit by metal theft, it's a huge public safety hazard. We definitely want to see some of these crimes never happen in the first place, and thank you for tackling the deterrence issue. I also want to just make one highlight. I know in terms of the deterrent factors, there's been a lot of, I think most people are aware of the payment by check mailed out later. I definitely want to highlight the mechanism that creates a class of commercial metals that can only be brought in by folks that hold a commercial account set up with a metal recycler. I think that's a very underrated and elegant part of this bill. One thing we were very cognizant of, we did not want to inhibit recycling because it's such a valuable service to society. I've heard anywhere from 95% or more of metal recycling is business to business. So I think to a large extent, metal recycling will be unfettered by this bill, and we tried to target non-ferrous metal sales to the general public, which is probably where the metal crimes are most likely to be occurring in that portion of metal recycling. Finally, I just want to close by acknowledging there are a lot of metal recyclers in the room today, and over the last 6 months, utilities such as myself have gotten to know a lot about these folks and the work they do. I want to be really clear that support for this bill in no way should be interpreted as pointing a finger at the metal recyclers. We know how very hard they work to be vigilant and to ferret out suspicious activity. I think the issue is when metal theft reaches epidemic levels, it can overwhelm the best practices of the industry. And I think by codifying a uniform and consistent best practice in the law, I think we're going to go a long way towards solving part of this problem. Some of the key provisions in this bill are actually codification of some of the best practices that metal recyclers employ. The commercial account idea, for example, is actually lifted from something that the Schnitzer Yard in Eugene does. I think they employ it a little bit differently than the way that this bill does, but that was something, an innovative approach that a metal recycler had employed, and it's being codified now into law. I just want to acknowledge that, and I'm very thankful for the work the metal recyclers do and look forward to working with them and all the other stakeholders. And finally, thank you to all the members of the work group, Representative Olson, Representative Barton, the chair, and your Senate counterparts. You've really paid a lot of attention to details here. We thank you for that, and I'll close with that.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much, panel. David Barenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg from the City of Portland, and I'll be very brief and would really agree with what's been said before me. The City of Portland considers a very major issue. We estimate that we've had over 800 cases of metal theft in the past year, possibly an additional 1,000 cases of catalytic converters. Our police bureau detectives who were involved in the discussions leading up to this bill wanted me to convey particularly their appreciation for the tools that you are providing them to be able to take on this challenge, and particularly want to thank the members of the work group for the access and input into crafting a bill that will really help to stem the problem. Just wanted to also point out one thing. Is since this bill started coming into play, we've had discussions with some of the metal recycling industry in Portland that has led to a couple of just other actions that we're taking locally, one of which is to develop an instantaneous reporting system. So we'll just let them know as soon as we do of what's been stolen so they can be on the lookout. And some of the companies have done exceptional jobs in being very vigilant as to stolen materials. Another item that we have done recently, or another task was, we had two training sessions with our police department, with recyclers, and with the DA's office, which had 60 employees of recyclers just trying to better coordinate how we address these issues. And we look towards building on that partnership and working together, and think that the partnership with the industry will really enhance what it is that we do, and we appreciate the work that they've done, and we appreciate the work that you've done, and urge your adoption of the bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Barenberg? Thank you, Mr. Barenberg. Warren Rosenfeld, Andrea Meyer, and Gail Meyer.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here today to speak about one specific concern, and I'm also here today expressing the concern shared by JOIN, which is a homeless service agency working in Portland quite successfully for many years to get people from homelessness into permanent living. Unfortunately, the executive director, Mark Jolin, and a client of his could not be here today. Otherwise, you'd be hearing from real voices, which I don't quite qualify for, but we share their concerns. And that is a very specific issue in this bill relating to the inability for a person to receive any cash payment for very small amounts of metal. The absence of a carve-out for these small amounts of scrap creates a very real burden on the poor and the homeless, because they obtain small amounts either through businesses providing it to them or dumpster diving, and they recycle that metal, and from that they can eke out a very minimal bare-bones living. And in some cases it helps them transition from homelessness to permanent housing, something that I know we all want to see happen more and more. The problem with receiving a check only probably isn't a problem for any of us sitting at this table or in this room. We have checking accounts, we have bank accounts, we can cash the check without problem. But those who are poor or homeless or on the street do not have checking accounts. And as a result, the only way they can cash the check is through a cashing service that takes money out of that small amount. So it has a significant burden on a very important population that cannot be here today, And what we are looking for is an exception for small amounts of cash payment to allow folks who are trying to live and eke out a living legally and survive on the streets, while at the same time still allowing the intent of this legislation and to shut down the illegal transactions going on from continuing. Providing that balance is very critical to us, and we urge some serious consideration be for a carve-out for small cash payments only.
Okay,
thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, the way I understand this is a delayed check, correct?
Yes, Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, not only delayed check, it's mailed to a street address. Now, some homeless are able to use homeless shelters and other facilities for an address, but that contains a burden, but yes.
Is there, and I don't know the technicalities of the bill, is there anything that prevents me from going there and saying, can you hold the check here and I'll come back and pick it up and have you cash it?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, it must be sent to the street address if it is. I'm looking at page 8. I believe the answer is no, and I'm not sure the businesses are going to start cashing the check. I mean, that adds the agreement of, I guess, the businesses agreeing to cash their own checks. I'm not sure they'd be able to do that because that could be an end run around potentially your whole legislation. If anyone could wait there, come back, and turn that check into cash for any amount. On page 8 is dealing with this, and I'm trying to read quickly to see if actually I believed it required the check be mailed to a street address, and if it was returned, that the business had to hold on to it for only a certain amount of days. So it creates two hurdles because it is being mailed to a street address, and then they have to cash the check.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are neutral on the bill. We've been analyzing it from the vantage point of representing and defending a scrap metal business that might get caught up within some of the crimes that are created in its provisions. And I really only want to make 2 points. For those that are going to be further looking at the bill and working with it, on page 4, lines 10, as part of the crime of unlawfully purchasing or receiving metal property, it talks about it would be unlawful to receive metal property from an individual whom the business knows or reasonably suspects has, according to information provided by a peace officer or law enforcement agency, been convicted within the past 5 years of a list of designated crimes. Given where the business may or may not be, that could be a lot of individuals. And so it's very difficult from the vantage point of the defense to prove a negative. It's very difficult to prove the absence of information or the absence of notice or the absence of knowledge. And so the mechanics of how the law enforcement agency gives that information to the scrap metal dealer is going to be very important, both in terms of the viability of the prosecution as well as the ability of the defense to establish a lack of notice. So I just point that out for those who are still working on the bill. Secondly, we do have concerns with Section 4 on page 5. This would really be, this is a hybrid basis. I don't really know what this is. It says that within, when a peace officer or law enforcement agency serves a subpoena for information on a business, then the business shall give that requested records to law enforcement not later than 2 business days after receiving the subpoena. In no instance am I aware of, in the civil or the criminal law, where a subpoena is something where someone can give you information and then 2 days come back, 2 days later come back and get it. A subpoena is a process by which information or a thing is brought before an official tribunal. It's before a court, it's before a magistrate, it's before a records deposition, it's before some other tribunal. It's not a basis by which someone can stand in front of an individual and say, I'm going to want your records, I'll be back in 2 days. And so the mechanics of this is almost akin to a search warrant, but it doesn't have the protections of a search warrant, doesn't have judicial oversight, doesn't have probable cause. I don't know what this is, but it's the first and only instance I know where it would be a subpoena where someone could just grab records without the records being compelled to be brought before a magistrate or a tribunal.
Counsel?
Ms. Myers, who normally issues a subpoena? Is it a court?
No. An attorney in an ongoing case can issue a subpoena. But, so for instance, in a criminal case, you can't issue a subpoena and have something brought to your office. You have to set up a court proceeding, and you have to subpoena the records to that court proceeding. So I would cite ORS 136.555. So, for instance, in the defense, frequently you want to get records prior to trial. You have to notice and set something on the docket prior to trial, and you have to subpoena the records to that court proceeding. You cannot subpoena those records to your office. Similarly, in a civil case, you have to notice and set up a records deposition, so the other party has noticed that you're subpoenaing those records to the records deposition.
And I hope that maybe Representative Siegel is grabbing the ORCPs, because it would seem that that should, if it's a civil proceeding, it should follow the ORCPs, and if it's a criminal, I think they need to do a search warrant. So I would just add that. I think we do have processes available, and we would share the concern about this process.
Again, Gilmeyer. So you're saying in the criminal proceedings, it would normally be the assistant district attorney that would issue the subpoena for records, not the police officer?
Correct. A lawyer needs to issue a subpoena.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and counsel, I can speak to what my recollection of what our intent was at the time. I believe the hang-up might be on the word subpoena, and there might, but I believe we intended to mirror existing procedures with respect to pawn shops. I thought that we actually used that language verbatim or close to it. It's my recollection.
Ms. Rosenfeld, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Warren Rosenfeld, president of CalBag Metals. And as just a citizen, I'm going to read my testimony, although I promise to read it with heart. Sometimes events are very close to home. A few months ago, a discrepancy in a container CalBag shipping manifest indicated an error in its loaded weight. Reviewing our video surveillance tape, supervisors determined the wrong commodities were being loaded by an employee into the container. We ultimately learned this metal would be redirected for unloading elsewhere in town before heading to the Port of Portland. The final discharge of our metal would be for a foreign buyer who had secured warehouse space in North Portland for the transloading. CalBag supervisors alerted the Portland Police Employee Theft Division, produced the evidence, and an arrest was made. Shortly thereafter, we were advised that a conviction was highly probable given the evidence, but the perpetrator would probably receive a 2-year suspended sentence with parole. The value of the metal was just under $10,000. Since the employee offered to make restitution, which included a $1,000 contribution to a charity of our choice, we agreed to a settlement. Lessons learned: nothing beats cameras. Even the best cases can't expect incarceration, and stolen metal doesn't just get sold down the street to the next unsuspecting scrapyard. Nearing 100 years of being in business, we can fairly be called the experts, expert enough to know we will ultimately receive obsolete scrap metal, equipment, or the production remnants of manufacturing from the likes of Boeing, Intel, and other manufacturers through legitimate pipelines of solid waste recovery, public recycling efforts, and industries in plant production handling programs. We aggressively, in bold letters, placard our operations, informing the public of what we will and won't buy. The attached photo of my testimony says it loud and clear for all who arrive or just pass by pass by on the street. All metal purchases are video surveyed. Our website advises the same, recommends safeguards to property owners, and provides links to industries-coordinated CICP and ISRI metal theft advisory websites. In fact, CalBag's combination of video surveillance, integrated purchase record keeping, scale purchase training, and the web-driven inter-industry theft alert program were all initiated well before the current laws were enacted in the 2007 legislature. After 100 years and third generation operators, the moral is we think about the future. Instead of targeting thieves, SB 570 places unwarranted blame on law-abiding businesses and provides little to no assistance to law enforcement, with no direct prevention of theft or the prosecution of the thieves. In its current form, this bill fails to deter and prevent theft, while imposing onerous burdens on recyclers and their legitimate customers. CalBag Metals has more than 200 public customer visits per day. They include regular visits by small scrap dealers who provide pickup services to the area's smaller manufacturers and fabricators, as well as demolition and construction companies, and a growing number of individual citizens who have accumulated scrap metal from do-it-yourself home remodeling, storm damage repair, or who have just taken the time to clean out the garage. To expedite the payment process, CalBag spent more than $150,000 earlier in the decade to provide a cash payment vending machine with a limited payment cap and fully integrated with our video purchase recording program. Small transactions avoid the onerous deductions to recapture our bank check writing fees. And yes, the customer avoided yet one more trip to the bank. And perhaps most remarkably, our incidence of check fraud went from almost 20 per year to zero, while saving $75,000 a year in bank check reconciliation fees. Indeed, CalBag Metals, until only a few years ago, made all payments by check, and metal theft existed then. Of course, under-resourced law enforcement agencies and overburdened DA offices continue to exist, effectively mitigating any chance of deterrence. We know this in real time. Our Tacoma, Washington recycling facility runs under the new cashless laws without any appreciable change in the incidence of theft and vandalism in the state. Let's be honest. Metal theft is a frustrating, horribly costly situation for all of us. But SB 570, as written, seeks to burden recyclers, in effect externalizing security costs. It certainly acts without the benefit of any serious data since the changes implemented last session. In the end, it will do nothing to impede theft or assure rightful punishment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just one real quick question. Gail, did you bring up this issue regarding Section 4 over on the Senate side?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And obviously, the intent is to try to reduce mental health, and certainly not to blame companies like yours, which have been for years been doing a great job trying to help deter mental theft. So thank you, Mr. Rosenfeld, for your testimony. Okay. Thank you. Representative Olson asked for a little more time to do a little more work on this. We'll close the public hearing.
Mr. Chairman, I have. I don't know if Jay Birchenbacher was going to share or not.
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I do have Jay Burcham, please.
Oh, as he's come, Mr. Chair, from my, he's come on. Representative Olson, on the CAG question you brought up, on the bottom of page 7, right up to page 8, it already says in the bill, I'm wondering if we need an amendment, because it says they shall not purchase or receive kegs or similar metallic containers used to store or dispense alcoholic beverages. I think that's covered already. Well, I don't think we're going to need that amendment, but whoever mentioned that.
I had the wrong one, too. What? Are you the A engrossed?
Yeah.
My 7 and 8 doesn't mention
that. Top of page 8, line 2.
It was just clarifying whether or not, I mean, there was going to be a problem with the distributors themselves being plugged into this. That was my main concern with it.
It says the distributor can do it.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Ms. Burcham, please. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Jay Burcham, Burcham's Metals, Albany, Oregon. I want to say thank you for your effort to confront the issue of metal theft. Senate Bill 570 has many good qualities, yet I do have some concerns. We as Oregonians are instrumental in leading our nation in recycling in a few ways. The bottle bill and our new water bottle bill, for example. SB 570 could represent a problem for legitimate recycling for scrap metals, resulting in scrap metal buildup in neighborhoods and in rural areas. With the economic crisis and the unemployment rate at high levels, the need to earn extra dollars for the family has become an important fact of life for many Oregon families. One way to help make ends meet is for these Oregonians to recycle scrap metal from their homes, neighbors, the farming community, and perhaps from small businesses. With the three-day hold and receiving the payment for their scrap metal 1 or 2 days after that could be a dreadfully long time, especially with children to feed and bills to pay. I am suggesting you consider allowing the ability to pay up to $50 cash, anything over that by check, and payable the same day as the transaction. If this is not acceptable to you, then please consider the $50 cash limit for daily, and then checks held for 3 days as already suggested, in an effort to help our Oregonians who are trying to supplement their income, but also just, or it is their only income, excuse me. It has already been mentioned about Section 4, and Mr. Rosenfeld has contributed also about the Calabag six-figure expense. We're a very small business in Albany, but I, too, believe it or not, have spent over $100,000 of our money to help fight this, to fight metal theft. There are many recyclers within the state that are functioning properly. There are some that aren't, and that is a true concern for us. But I want you to know that we work closely with law enforcement already, and that's our heart's desire, is to develop that relationship within our county, and we have expanded that from Linn County into Benton County. With that, I want you to also to picture receiving a phone call from law enforcement that our office would take and alerting us to something that's been stolen. What we do there is we have a theft report form that our people in the office will take that call, and they will respond accordingly by filling in that form from law enforcement. And then also the victim may very well call us as well and give us additional information. We will then get on the radio and we will contact all employees. And within a few minutes, we will have everyone come into the office over a period of just a short time. They will read that theft report and initial it, proving that they are aware of what we need to be looking for. Thus, we are on standby, and we will call law enforcement upon arrival if it does come our way. Many times it has come our way, and we've been able to help local law enforcement with the apprehension of the criminal. Many recyclers already have what Section 4 is talking about, and that is fantastic, and I wanted you to know that. I do have some concerns about the bill that I just want to have some bullet points for you to consider and perhaps talk to me about later, even after the meeting. But I'm concerned about the enforcement of this potential law. Looking at the history of its predecessor that Mr. Stone already talked about was House Bill 3026, effective January 1 of 08. Also, the effective communication between the DA's office, law enforcement, to the recycler, the relationship that needs to be developed from there. And then just two more. Information from law enforcement on whom I cannot do business with, which was already mentioned just a few minutes ago. That's a real concern for me. And then lastly, for my bullet points, is what I call the unemployable. And it's already been mentioned here as well, I believe, by Andrea earlier. When you have someone that is sincerely trying to change their life, but they have been convicted and they have served time in jail, in prison, and now they're released, and they're released into this economic situation that we have. yes, there are some that will instantly return to crime, but there are others that want and strive to start a new life. It's hard to get a job today anyway, but when you have a record, it's even worse. If that person does desire to do something legitimately, to earn some money, it's very, very difficult to find something. But as a benefit to all of us for recycling, that person has the opportunity to gather scrap metals legitimately and bring that in. But the way this is currently set up for me, I cannot do business with that person. I understand the logic behind it, but I do have a concern about it. But lastly, I want to thank Representative Olson for his efforts on this bill. He's been very helpful and supportive of our efforts to help law enforcement in our county. Karen Blythe, who's not here today, of Construction Industry Crime Prevention, has done an outstanding job of communicating with recyclers in the Pacific Northwest and alerting us on items that have been stolen so we can be on the lookout for those items. And then lastly, Jeff Stone, for his involvement for the chair of the coalition that's been mentioned that I have been a part of for 3 years. So again, thank you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming in and your testimony. Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, just a real quick question. Please. You described a person who had just wanted to do the right thing, has been released from prison. If they have a state-issued ID, what prevents them from, or prevents you from doing business with them?
It should be page 4, I think. Just 1 second, sir. Yes, page 4. Oh, thank you. Line 10. You'll see that the information that I need to obtain is from a peace officer that's already been shared today. An individual that has been convicted in the past 5 years. It says theft, but obviously metal theft, but it's also inclusive of drugs, burglary, other items. I personally have a friend that made some very poor choices. He has served time, and he's living in Albany in an Oxford house. And he has 3 felons. And he's a very intelligent young man, but he made a choice of a drug involvement. Yeah. And sad story, but to the end of it here, he's having an extremely hard time getting employment. I try to encourage him. I do not want him to go back to the life that he led prior. He has a clean chalkboard for many of us and how we view him because he has served his time. But he is finding it extremely difficult. So that's where I'd be, Representative Cameron.
So if somebody comes in with an ID, they have to be on a list that's been provided to you by...
I have no way of knowing who those people would be without information from local law enforcement.
Right.
Okay. So with their ID, I do not have an issue with their identification, but I need to be informed by local law enforcement who they say I can do business with or who I cannot.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 570 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 745, Senator Bonamici, please.
I thought all these things have been resolved in the Senate. They've had all 4 months.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 745, which deals with a somewhat esoteric topic of reciprocal attorney fee provisions. I wanted to let you know that you probably already know this, Chair Barker and committee, because the Judiciary Committee staff and council do such a great job. But this bill passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with 4 aye votes and 1 excused, and it passed on the Senate floor with 29 aye votes and 1 excused. But even with that astounding record, I thought it was important to come and tell you why I brought this bill forward. Current Oregon law allows the award of attorney fees to a prevailing party in a civil action on a contract, whether the contract is expressed or implied. And this is true even if the prevailing party claims that the contract is void or unenforceable. So if you're sued and you prove that the contract was void or for some reason it couldn't be enforced, you're still entitled to get your attorney's fees. And it's even true if the contract says that the attorney's fees go to one side and not the other, because it's a reciprocal provision. It says that if somebody prevails on the contract, they get their attorney's fees. But what happens is, what if somebody's identity is stolen and they're sued for a debt that somebody else incurred? Well, what's happened is that we've had a couple of court of appeals opinions, a couple of court opinions who say, well, that's not a party to the contract anymore. So these are people who are completely innocent of the claims, but they may need to hire an attorney to defend themselves because they're being sued for a debt. And the way the statute is currently, that ID theft victim is simply out of luck. So they have to pay their own defense costs because they're neither a party to the contract, and they aren't really asserting that the contract was void or unenforceable. They're asserting that they weren't a party to the contract. So Senate Bill 745 fixes that unfairness by simply adding that fees can be recovered when a person is sued on a contract and prevails by proving that he or she was not a party to the contract. And I have one example that I can give you of a specific example of someone who was had his identity stolen. He was sued by a debt buyer who was bringing a lawsuit that was a breach of contract lawsuit, and he had to hire an attorney to defend himself, and they kept asserting that it wasn't his claim. It went through an arbitration. They ended up actually trying to convince the arbitrator that under these statutes they should be able to get his attorney's fees, but the arbitrator looked at the couple of cases and said that was impossible to do that. They did issue some sanctions in that case, but Chair Barker and members of the committee, this simply says that for victims of identity theft or someone who proves that they're not a party to the contract, they're entitled to an award of attorney's fees, just as they would be had they proved that the contract was void or unenforceable. And I thank you for listening to the testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonamici, how often does this occur where someone pursues the victim in a lawsuit?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, I don't know how often in terms of numbers, but I happen to know that there are companies that do business as debt buyers, and they just buy a lot of debt, and then sometimes for pennies on the dollar, and so they start suing, and so I think it happens frequently. There's a couple of consumer protection attorneys who have an office in my district. I learned about this issue from them, and certainly enough to deserve a change in the statute to protect those people who are identity theft victims and are stuck in this situation.
Just follow up then, Mr. Please. Chair. Where I'm wanting to go with this is, most people who are victims of ID theft report that to law enforcement?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, yes, they do.
Okay, then follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Then do not these companies that are pursuing this not take in consideration the report that's submitted by law enforcement in the investigation?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, apparently not. I don't think that they do. Their job is to collect the debt. And so they sue on the contract, asserting that a debt is formed by the contract. And so people are in the situation where they do have to defend against that lawsuit. And if they were, like explained, if they were proving that the contract was unenforceable for some reason, then they would be entitled to their attorney's fees. But the courts have held that if they're not really a party to the contract, they can't use that statute. So this bill is intended to fix that I guess you could call it a loophole in the law.
Hmm.
Probably wasn't anticipated originally because there weren't that many victims of identity theft.
Further questions for Senator? Thank you, Senator.
Cool.
Thank you, committee.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I would love to note, however, how welcoming this committee was to you when you came back. A marked contrast to my appearance in front of her committee yesterday.
We'll take that up later. Thank you.
I missed that.
I got beat up pretty good.
Ouch.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 745. Open a work session on Senate Bill 745.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 745 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 745 to the floor with a due pass.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
And question, Representative Wisnett.
I have a question for Representative Barton. Representative Barton, are there going to be enough lawyers coming through law school to take all these new responsibilities on?
Absolutely, unequivocally.
Time will tell, Representative. Time will tell.
I do have some concern, though, Mr. Chair, with this bill. I mean, I clearly understand it, but it does bother me that you have agencies out there that, for some reason, I guess, apparently don't heed a report of an investigation, you know, from a law enforcement agency identifying that, in fact, you have a legitimate ID theft and that the victim was legitimately victimized. It almost makes you kind of wonder, why do the investigation then?
We have a motion before us to move Senate Bill 745 to the due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Excused.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Any lawyers want to carry that? Representative Barton will carry that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 298.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 298 prohibits returning a forfeited animal to a person in the same household, requires written acknowledgement of rights and responsibilities of a person receiving the forfeited animal, requires agreement that the new owner give animal minimum care, and states that giving the animal to the abuser constitutes a crime. Creates the crime of encouraging animal abuse, defined as knowingly allowing the person who forfeited the animal because of abuse to possess the animal, designates violations as a Class C misdemeanor with a fine of $1,250 and up to 30 days in jail. There's no amendment, there's no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Bonnie Helzer and Sharon Harmon, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society, and much to Representative Barton's relief, I am not here to talk about puppy mills. I am here to talk about Senate Bill 298. The Oregon Humane Society urges you to vote yes on this bill. This really closes a loophole that was left open when this original law was put into place that precludes a person convicted of animal abuse from possessing a pet. There have been numerous attempts to go around the law. There have been successful placements. People are just so clever these days. We'd like to put this bill into law and close that loophole and keep pets out of the homes of animal abusers. There have also been some enterprising folks who represent themselves as adopters with the full intent to take the pet that's been abused and give it back to the abuser. And that's just flat wrong. And Senate Bill 298, surely housekeeping, closes the loophole and keeps abused animals out of the homes of convicted animal abusers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Bonnie Helzer. I'm a special agent for the Oregon Humane Society. As Ms. Harmon said, this is basically a housekeeping bill, so I won't go on and on about it. But in my daily job as a special agent, I come across this so often, and this bill would help very much with the issue of wives, siblings, children that say that the animal is actually mine. Give me back the animal, and I promise I won't let my husband, my brother, my friend abuse the animal ever again. We all know that that's unreasonable. If they're residing in the same home, of course they're going to have access to that animal. We can't monitor them 24/7. It is unrealistic to replace the animal in the same residence that the offender is in. It also may make the family and friends of the offender stop and think about the serious issue that animal abuse and neglect really is when they are now held responsible for allowing the access and possession of the offender to that animal. I just really urge support of 298, and I'm happy that you allowed me to speak with before you today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Harmon, did Farm Bureau and Cattlemen's weigh in on this? Any?
We've had no real opposition. The bill passed out of the Senate, 29 yes votes. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, I remember on the Senate side we did change. We made the amendment from to add minimum care as because that's already defined in statute.
Yeah.
That was, I think it was the concern of the Farm Bureau that we made that change for.
Thank you.
Senator Whitsett had the concern.
Thank you.
Representative Frazier, please.
Allows a person forfeited the animal because of abuse to possess the animal. You're talking about that animal and the other animals in the home or outside in the yard.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, it applies to ownership of domestic animals. It is broader than the original animal that is abused. For this particular statute, it relates to the animal that, the particular animal that has been abused.
Is there a definition of domestic animals that include livestock and those types of things?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, livestock are carved out of this particular statute. Although they are domesticated, they have a specific definition. Domestic animals do not include cattle, sheep, the assorted emus, pigs, horses, the usual suspects.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
You know, I've investigated some cases over the years where livestock have been involved and abused, and this absolutely, I think, would be perfect for them right now. I know it.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
He's just making a point.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. You're confusing me. Yeah. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Which is easily done, I might add.
He said it.
Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 298. Open a work session.
Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
Move Senate Bill 298 is amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 298 to the floor of the due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Excuse me.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schill.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Somebody like to carry that? Bill? Representative Olson, would you carry that for us, please?
Sure.
Thank you. Over to public hearing on Senate Bill 601.
Who likes the animal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 601A clarifies the authority of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots to issue subpoenas for investigatory purposes, allows the Board of Maritime Pilots to enter a ship for investigatory purposes if the ship is open to the public, requires a warrant for inspections of ships that are not open to the public, and entrance is denied by the owner. This has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. David Hatton, Kim Duncan, and Ann McIntyre, please. Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Kim Duncan, and I am the chair of the Board of Maritime Pilots. We're happy to be here today to talk to you about Senate Bill 601. Also with me is David Hatton, who is the Assistant Attorney General, provides legal counsel to our board, and Captain Ann McIntyre, a member of the Board of Maritime Pilots. She is also a captain on the Columbia River and does the bulk of the investigations that this bill concerns itself with. I'd like to give you a little bit of background about the bill, and have Mr. Hatton talk to you about the legal aspects of it, and have Captain McIntyre discuss the investigation procedure. Senate Bill 601 has a lot of support, passed out of the Senate with 28 votes. It came to the legislature unanimously from our board, and it also has the support of the major stakeholders of our board, and these include the Columbia River Pilots, the Columbia River Bar Pilots, and the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. What it does, as your counsel indicated, is provide the board with subpoena power when it conducts maritime incident investigations. Keep in mind that the Board of Maritime Pilots' major job is to provide safe passage for ships on every one of our navigational grounds, the Bar, the Columbia River, Yaquina Bay, and Coos Bay. When there is a maritime incident, we also are charged with investigating that incident. And we do that very rapidly, and we try to talk with the captain, the pilot, the crew, and obtain all relevant information and help us understand what happened and why it happened. And then we consequently provide an assessment of the incident. If there is discipline to be meted to a pilot, we can do that. If there are lessons to be learned, and there frequently are, we do that and share that within the industry. So this authority will help us in conducting timely and efficient investigations. The subpoena authority will also assure us that we get pertinent information quickly. And quickness and timeliness are very important in this industry. First of all, ships are on a schedule. They want to get into port. They want to get out of port. We want to get on board, take care of the incident, and allow things to move forward. Why are we bringing it before you now? Well, it has to do with an assessment this board did of its investigatory capacity following an incident about a year ago that you probably read about in San Francisco Bay, where a ship hit a pier of the Bay Bridge. And when that happened, which was a very important and very significant and very costly incident, we went back to say, if anything like that happened up here, do we have all the tools we need to effectively, efficiently, quickly understand what happened? And what we discovered is we needed this authority. So we urge you to support this bill and help us do our job as well as we possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is David Hatton. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. The department has not taken a position on this bill, but I'm here to answer questions. The board investigates incidents involving maritime pilots where there has been either an accidental grounding, an unintended collision or elision, the loss of life, or serious injury related to the operation of a vessel, or any accident involving 25,000 or some damage or more. Senate Bill 601 would authorize the board to issue subpoenas, investigative subpoenas. Currently, there are five agencies that have that, can issue investigative subpoenas. Chairman Duncan mentioned that time is of the essence in these investigations. Many ships are in port 18 hours, and probably on average less than 2 days before they ship out. The board currently can only issue subpoenas only if it opens a contested case under an administrative procedure, under the Administrative Procedures Act. The board would have to actually vote to open up a case and then refer the matter to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and often that's going to take more than the 1 or 2 days that would allow the board to timely go in and talk to the operators of the vessel and look at the circumstances in the accident. The board is also asking for authority to enter and inspect the premises of a ship, and under the legislation as outlined by council, the representative of the board would offer credentials to the owner or operator of the occupant of the premises that where the investigation is to be conducted, and then only if that owner or operator or occupant declines to allow the inspection would the board go to court and seek authority to issue to have a warrant issues. Generally, parties do cooperate with the board, but there have been notable exceptions where occupants or owners haven't agreed to any kind of inspection. Ultimately, I think this legislation is designed to allow the board to, in a timely way, access the information and the premises that are needed for it to carry out its statutory duty.
I'd just like to ask one question. I'm kind of curious. I don't know. I mean, I remember several years back when there was a Soviet Union, their merchant fleet was owned by the state. And so those were like foreign countries. And so in those circumstances, if you issued a subpoena, would they have to, if the court issued a subpoena, would they have to allow somebody on board? Or
if a ship is on an Oregon pilotage ground, they would be subject to the court's authority, and the Coast Guard also would have authority over those ships as well. Often they conduct investigations at the same time as the board does.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ann McIntyre. I'm a member of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, and I'm also a pilot on the Columbia River. I think my colleagues have done an excellent job of explaining the necessity for this legislation. I can recount to you anecdotally one incident where I was unable to gather information that I needed in order to conduct an investigation. About 2 years ago, we had a container ship that was outbound from the Port of Portland that ran aground in the navigational channel on an uncharted shoal. When I arrived on board the vessel about 6 hours after the grounding, I was denied access to the log books, the charts, any kind of written information that would provide me with the information I needed in order to conduct the investigation. Fortunately, because the Board of Maritime Pilots does have a good working relationship with the United States Coast Guard, I was able to obtain this information from the Coast Guard and complete the investigation. But this is just an example of an instance where we then discovered that we needed to be able to act more quickly to obtain the information and before the ships depart the river system.
Okay. Questions, Representative Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and anybody on the board, or I'm in the panel, can mention, you know, and you already mentioned just briefly the U.S. Coast Guard. That's what my question was going to be, is were they involved in all this, and more, were they involved with the incident that you described, Kim, regarding San Francisco?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Olson, the Coast Guard is frequently involved in these investigations, particularly those that we call significant investigations above a certain monetary threshold. They're looking at one set of issues. We are indeed looking at another set of issues. But there is a lot of collaboration, but since we're both looking for different things, there isn't a duplication of effort. We try to make it efficient.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But before, I have probably a couple relatively technical questions, perhaps for Mr. Haddon. But I'd like to preface my remarks by acknowledging a former representative who is actually with us today, Don Butch, who is actually a longtime mayor of Newport when I was growing up, and a former member of this chamber, I believe mid-'80s, before former Representative Brenneman, if I'm not mistaken. But I haven't seen him in many years. Delighted to see him. Mr. Haddon, a question regarding Section 2, which, of course, gives you essentially delegates authority to the board to issue subpoenas directly. I'm actually wondering what the necessity of it is, because I read current statute 776.115, subsection 6,
it almost contains the verbatim language. And I know in your testimony you said that, I think you implied that subsection 6 was bound by the procedures of the APA under 183. But I actually don't see that in the statute. It's not obvious to me what the value added of section 2 is.
The Attorney General manual addresses this in some detail, and I apologize, I don't have the specific citation to it, but there has to be specific authority to an agency to issue investigative subpoenas as opposed to issuing subpoenas once a contested case is open. And I've referred to in the testimony the five other agencies that currently have authority to issue investigative subpoenas, and the value added here is that as needed, the board would be able to issue those subpoenas without opening the contested case proceeding.
I see.
And I think that broad language has been interpreted in court decisions as not allowing the issue of
Thank you. Well, I understand. Thank you. If I follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So there is a subtle language distinction in conduct or authorize the holding. I would have thought that subpoenaing witnesses in preparation in the furtherance of authorizing a contested case hearing was largely the same thing, but I'll take your word for it that case law says otherwise. Regarding Section 3, I'm just wondering, speaking more broadly, I suppose, if there aren't larger Fourth Amendment implications to this, regardless of whether or not we wish to delegate authority under Section 3, whether or not we even can, or are we not bounded in some ways by the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, of course? Alternatively, what if, despite this, the exclusionary rule apply to this as well?
Your question.
It was not a specific question, I admit, so much as an expression of generalized concern. I'm wondering if there's
in your opinion. This statute is essentially an inspection statute. There are a number of agencies that have inspection authority. This is actually modeled after a Public Utility Commission statute. So there are a number of agencies that regulate that do have inspection authority. With respect to First Amendment or Fourth Amendment issues, the warrant clause clearly would apply to the board. There is some case law, I think, indicating that in intensely regulated areas, there's no warrant requirement, but I would not suggest that a licensing agency would approach that level of regulation. Under the statute, proposed language of this bill, we would, if the owner or occupant refuses or declines the inspection, we would be going to court obtain a warrant.
I see.
And so we have tried to incorporate procedural protections consistent with.
Oh, there it says it right there. I'm so sorry. Line 27. Thank you.
One.
And I'm pretty sure the answer is, so I already missed the warrant in line 27. Also, when conducting an investigation there in line 15, I'm fairly confident that there is an assumed requirement that investigation be reasonable or meet some kind of rational basis.
There would have to be a nexus between the maritime incident and the investigation.
Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Do
you mind if I go? Do you have enough votes here?
We do. Okay. Thank you very much, Representative. And I'll be a little bit late. I've got to testify on the Senate side at 3.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the Columbia River Bar Pilots, and say we support this bill and support the actions of the board. If there are any technical questions, I'd refer them to Mr. Douglas.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. We bring the vessels in to the ports and take them out, book the vessels. We are very supportive of this legislation. I'd like to compliment Chair Duncan. She has gone at great lengths to answer any industry concerns regarding this bill, has continued to keep us informed of its progress, and we're here to support Senate Bill 601.
Thank you. Any questions? Panel? No? Thank you very much. Public hearing on Senate Bill 601. Open a work session on Senate Bill 601.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnap.
Gene Wisnap.
Yeah. Colonel.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 601A to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 601A to the floor of a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Martin.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Excuse.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Excused.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Stigler.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wizard. Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Do consent unless Barton is the chair.
Do you want to consent or do you want to?
Garrett.
Is there an objection to consent? We have a consent calendar. Any further business before the committee today?